You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Ian and Eli.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Bob.
How are you guys?
Doing fine.
Okay, well, that's, I guess, all a person can hope for these days. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You two are Ian Lustig and Eli Clifton, co-authors of a new book called Israel's Lobby. I guess you could say a successor of sorts to a well-known book called The Israel Lobby by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Waltz, but with a number of differences, not to mention the fact that the landscape has changed pretty appreciably since then in a number of ways. And so I wanted to, let me say a little more about you, actually. Ian, you're a professor in the political science department at Penn and emeritus now. You've been there a while. You've worked for the State Department in the past. You were at Dartmouth for a while. Eli, you are at the Quincy Institute, as you know. I think you were, are you a co-founder technically?
I am.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And the Quincy Institute is doing very well. It's become a prominent voice in foreign policy, and is certainly a distinctive one. So, yeah, Ian, let me talk to you now. I have known you for some time because I taught at Penn actually for a few years, about 22 years ago. And I remember, I think, a conversation that we had about your history as someone who was a Jewish critic of Israel before that was cool, you might say. And back when we talked, it still wasn't cool, but it's gotten cooler, at least if not in our generation so much, in something closer to Eli's generation. And you wrote a paper about your history as a scholar of the Middle East in this particular context. And I want to quote something for it. You said your mentor, Ernie Haas, I'm quoting directly now, who left Nazi Germany with his family in the late 1930s, supported my efforts, but only after telling me my project was a giant mistake. And then you quote him saying, "The politics of working on Arab-Israeli stuff will make your life miserable. It will ruin your career." Well, it hasn't totally ruined your career. I mean, I'll let you do the damage assessment. I mean, you've made a living. You're an emeritus at an Ivy League school. So ruin maybe was an overstatement, but has it made your life miserable or at least uncomfortable? Like, what would you say?
No, it has not made my life miserable or uncomfortable. It's made it very interesting. I know that my career has been affected in many ways. In the article you talk about, I detail some of those incidents, some of those, struggles that occurred. But Ernie, my mentor, a wonderful guy, did not have as thick a skin as I do and wasn't as willing to engage with the emotionally fraught topic. For him, it was an emotionally fraught topic. For me as well, but I actually have been able to work through those emotions. And I also developed a sense of humor about this because once you learn enough about it, you can see how smart people who have enormous expertise in their domains, and then they're just off the rails entirely when they start to talk about Israel and the Palestinians, the Middle East. And I find it very interesting to enter their world and gradually expose them to things they never knew before and see what happens.
So by off
I'm
the
really
rails,
for that.
By off the rails, you mean ideologically or just in terms of their knowledge base? You just think they actually don't understand the situation?
Actually, it's mostly their knowledge base. Mm-hmm. There aren't too many people with really what we would call sophisticated, strong Zionist ideological positions. Those disappeared decades and decades ago, except on the extreme right. But what many people who have supported Israel in a knee-jerk way or in a natural way, is socialized to support whatever Israel does, I just don't understand at all that this problem, if they're a brain surgeon or if they're a corporate lawyer or they're an engineer, has the same level of complexity as the areas in which they work. And bringing that level of complexity slowly into their view, if they're, they're not dummies, they can see, whoa, what have I been doing? And I find that very satisfying and have done so throughout my career. I think the fact is, however, that from the early 1970s, when I launched a petition campaign against settlements in the occupied territories and for a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza, that there were only 1,100 settlers on the West Bank beyond Whoa. Jerusalem. At that time, there are now 580,000 or more than half a million outside East Jerusalem. So people, even on the left, thought that I was nuts, and I was called an anti-Semite. I was called a Nazi. And we were this small group called Yesh Brera. There is an alternative. We only operated among Jews. We did not go to the Gentile press. We were trying to be good Zionists, as it were. And that experience showed me just how, first of all, how prescient I could be by applying political science to real knowledge about the Middle East. I could anticipate that the settlements, as small as they were going, as I said at that time, lock the Jewish people and lock the Jewish state into a political dungeon from which it would never escape. Those were words I wrote in 1972, when there were only, as I said, a few settlers in the West Bank. But throughout my career, I've used the Arab-Israeli conflict as a way to investigate political science and use political science as a way to investigate that. The conflict, I have not been offered positions or prizes I would have been offered. I have had to struggle for contracts that I would otherwise not have to struggle for. A point when I was being recruited here at Penn from Dartmouth, a jihad was launched against me by alumni and other luminaries who did not want someone with my objective views of the Middle East to be teaching at Penn. Every single book that I've written about the Middle East has required a kind of war, except for this last one, in order to get published, because the publishers and the editors came under such pressure not to go forward with the project. So it's a distinctive career path, but one that I've been happy with, proud of, and thankful for.
Mm. And I'm curious, when you say they thought you were nuts, it sounds like you're talking about liberal Jewish Zionists, by and large, who thought you were nuts when you talked about a two-state solution. And so only 5 years before you were talking about that, the West Bank hadn't been Israeli territory at all, because this was before the Six-Day War. So I'm curious as to why it seems so strange to them that you might set up an arrangement where the West Bank wasn't part of Israel, which only recently it hadn't been. Is that because they didn't see the need for it? They didn't think there was some big crisis you needed to head off that was looming in the future, or what?
Well, for the most part, most of these Jews just saw Palestinians at that time as terrorists, as anti-Semitic terrorists. In 1969, I spent 6 months in Israel as a junior at college. I was at Brandeis, and I wrote a paper then on what West Bank Arabs want by going to Gaza, actually mostly the West Bank, but also Gaza. And then I published this in a Zionist journal called The Jewish Frontier. What do they really want? I don't care what the PLO is saying. What do Arabs who live there want? And what I reported is they want a separate Palestinian state. The PLO will eventually say this, but they can't say it now. And even now, it's difficult for them to say. That was my first published article. And that knowledge that I had was so far from the understanding of most Jews that when I published an article or two in the Jewish student newspaper in Berkeley, where I was a member of that community called the Jewish Radical, that when that article came out about how American Jews should actually contribute some money to Palestinian refugees because, like it or not, establishing the state of Israel hurt Palestinians. Well, I was called in by my rabbi at my Orthodox shul in Berkeley and told that because of that article, he was firing me from being a teacher in the Hebrew school. That was under pressure, he said, from another synagogue who had seen the article, and that was it. So even before I started teaching, I was fired from a job as a Hebrew teacher because of that article, a Sign of the Times.
Mm-hmm. Did you say it was an Orthodox shul or a conservative shul?
Yes.
It was Orthodox. So you were you brought up Orthodox? And
I was both brought up kind of conservadox, but I'm always much more comfortable in Orthodox services.
Okay.
Because of the Hebrew.
Okay. So, yeah. So it's like Catholics who wish they still did the Mass in Latin, I guess.
yeah, right.
So, Eli, I hadn't actually planned to ask you this, but this has been very interesting to hear from Ian. So is there anything you want to say about your personal journey that got you interested in Israel and how it has or hasn't been a problem for you career-wise or any other way?
It's certainly been the third rail throughout my career as a journalist and an investigative journalist who is very interested in the intersection of money and politics and U.S. foreign policy. And it's always, sort of as a broad theme of my career been something that I felt strongly about, the notion that U.S. foreign policy often gets treated as something that is determined and influenced in sort of this nebulous different way than other contested policy areas. And as a journalist in Washington, D.C., and now I'm in New York, I would regularly cover the think tanks in Washington. And I could see that they were shaping, this was sort of global war on terror years, GWAT, early 2000s. I could see that they were shaping the news coverage of what were, clearly this is sort of pre-surge Iraq war, this is Afghanistan, periods in which there were real misgivings about emerging about the foreign policies that had been advocated by the neoconservatives. But these think tanks were really effectively functioning as an echo chamber for the media and for elected members of Congress, because they would frequently testify before them. They would be talking heads in the media. And indeed, at that point, they had very good access in the George W. Bush White House as well. I'm talking about think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute and the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And in looking at that, I quickly started to see that, so what is their driving interest in these issues? And I started to dig into sort of who are the donors to these think tanks, as well as, what explains such a strong interest in the Middle East and in a really hawkish U.S. foreign policy there. It seems like it's going quite poorly at the moment. And it became quite apparent that Israel was a central piece of this. Again, not speculating here, purely looking at what people were saying at the time. You only need to look at the folks who are very much shaping the policies of the George W. Bush administration, both in the Pentagon as well as in the White House, to see that was a major factor for them, was trying to remake the Middle East in a manner that they thought was going to be particularly beneficial to Israel and to the United States, in fairness. I think that they thought both could be true at the same time. And again, throughout my career, so that's where I sort of went down this path of wanting to understand sort of what are the financial networks in Washington that seem to be shaping our foreign policy. And the further I got in it, the more I saw that this is simply special interest at play. Again, no different than a lot of other spaces. In most other spaces, you tend to have contesting special interests, even in areas, social policy, about same-sex marriage or about taxes or about the environment. You tend to have multiple participants in that. And what you certainly could see in the formation of our foreign policy was that is not always the case. Indeed, it might be more common that there is only one special interest in the room at any given time. There might be multiple ones around, but one in the room at any given time on any significant policy issue than not. And I think that sort of drove me in this direction.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, most Americans don't think a ton about foreign policy unless Americans start coming home in body bags in significant numbers, as they did in Vietnam. So you naturally wind up with a situation where an intensely motivated interest group, Cuban lobby is certainly an example, can have a disproportionate influence on policy. I was interested to hear you guys, see you guys point out, I didn't know this, George Washington pointed to the generic problem, but more in the context of French influence. I mean, the issue of American relations with France in his day, but I guess he understood that in some policy areas, small interest groups would have more influence than in others. Foreign policy is certainly the main exemplar of that, I guess. So now the subtitle of your book is America in the Grip of a Foreign Power. Now, okay, so it's Israel's lobby, America in the Grip of Foreign Power. One thing that struck me about that, I you know, one theme here in this conversation will be how things have changed since the Walt Mearsheimer book, The Israel Lobby, which was what now, 2 decades ago? How many years exactly? Like about
20 years ago. Yeah.
19, I guess.
19, okay. Well, and, you know,
from the essay is 20.
Oh, wow.
Right. The essay is what I actually read. I never read the whole book, but there was an essay that then kind of became the book, morphed into the book. And, you know, a number of things have changed, which we'll talk about. I know you can talk about the way the lobbies, and we'll get around to defining the lobby as you see it. It goes beyond AIPAC, certainly in their definition, and I think in yours. The way it wields influence has changed, you argue, but also the speech code, so to speak, has changed, right? And part of the influence, you know, of a number of interest groups really is to try to shape like what it's acceptable to say and what it's not acceptable to say. And when I first saw that title, America in the Grip of Foreign Power, I thought, why, when I was a boy, a person would have gotten tarred and feathered as an anti-Semite just for saying that. And look, I'm sure you've probably heard from people who say the subtitle means that you're an anti-Semite, but I'm guessing that if the publisher of the Walt Mearsheimer book had seen that as a proposed subtitle, it was for R. Strauss and Giroux, as I remember, they would have said, wait, you know, we're willing to publish this book, but we're not going to let you make the subtitle America in the Grip of Foreign Policy. Do you kind of know what I mean about the way...
Yes, I know what you mean, but I think the fact is that the world has changed so mm-hmm. that subtitle would not have been appropriate 20 years ago, but
so
it's
more accurate now, you're saying. Not, yeah, it isn't just the speech code that's changed. Okay, that's interesting.
That's right. Okay. It's not just, but this is what happened is this. The Walt Mearsheimer book is a terrific book. As you pointed out yourself, it was not read by the general public, because the reviews smeared them as anti-Semites, and most people didn't read the book, so the reviews never had to deal with the evidence. But that book was in a long tradition of scholarly books and memoirs that said and documented the extent to which American foreign policy interests had been compromised over the years by subservience to the requirements of the Israel lobby that there be no daylight between the United States and Israel. So that's an established argument. They made it better and more thoroughly than anyone else had done. We make the same argument. It's continued since then. But the big change that has occurred is that because Israel became so extreme, we say crazy for very good reasons, that the lobby is not able any longer to even pretend to be able to defend Israeli policies. That required them 20-some years ago to start developing techniques for suppressing debate and preventing discussion of Israel publicly, because any public discussion would result in an argument they would lose. First, they started saying certain arguments that supposedly delegitimize or demonize or use a double standard, those are anti-Semitic. Then they escalated, and we show how they started attacking the people who make the arguments as anti-Semitic. But what we see in this later stage is an attack on the institutions, on civil society that produce the people who make the arguments they don't want discussed. That's why, because we have in mind when we say America, civil society, the attack on the media, on the entertainment industry, on universities. This is what we mean by America in the grip of a lobby that cannot tolerate open, honest debate about the merits of the policies that they are insisting the United States subsidize.
I think the thing that really jumps out to me about the formulation is sort of an odd way of getting back to this, which is that so often a common rebuttal, at least that I encounter, is people love whataboutisms, right? So the obvious whataboutism is, well, what about the Qataris? What about the Saudis? What about the Emiratis? What about the Chinese? They all spend a lot of...
In other words, to be clear, people say, often by way of insinuating anti-Semitism, they say, look, if you're really so concerned about this kind of injustice, why aren't you complaining about other countries that are perpetrating comparable injustices, right?
Yes, but also in the context of spending a lot of money to try to influence American policy. And I think...
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I think when you...
Because the Qataris, the Saudis, they support some think tanks and so on.
I get it.
Okay.
And spend a lot of money on American universities and what have you, as well as various messaging and lobbyists down the list. And I think, but when you compare it to the list of things that Ian just mentioned, the areas in which Israel's lobby is affecting our civil society, is certainly influencing our foreign policy, is impacting our national security, is costing us quite a, not an insignificant amount of money since it's our largest recipient of foreign assistance and foreign aid, you start to see that this is certainly in a completely different league and category. Not just of influence, but in terms of cost that it's imposing on Americans.
Also shifting the outcomes of primaries, of elections, and manipulating them without even talking about Israel. That is, as Eli can explain in detail, the money that poured into Michigan and to try to defeat Abdul Saeed's candidacy was the commercials that were produced. I think you said that only 3 out of 100 were even mentioned the word Israel. So, and that's for Republican money trying to change the outcome of a Democratic primary by arguing that their favored candidate, Haley Stevens, could do a better job of defeating the Republican candidate, Rogers, only now to see the lobby switch to support the candidate they said they were trying to defeat. So this is the kind of
the Republican candidate, in other words,
all while refusing to talk about the singular issue, which is drawing this money into the race, that is motivating all of this out of state and out of party money into Michigan. That's mobilizing the UDP's $30 million effort, which is about to probably increase significantly for the general election inside Michigan. And it's all because of Israel. But that's the one thing they don't want to talk about.
So you're saying this is pretty new. In other words, 20 years ago, they just would have said, when they're arguing against the candidate, the commercials would have said, this person's anti-Israel.
Sure.
And that was the message. Yes. But now that message isn't selling the same way. So they point to some other aspect of the record, totally like irresponsible on guns or the environment.
Well, and just as significantly, they wouldn't have needed to spend $30 million to try to get a pro-Israel candidate to win the nomination to be the Democratic Senate candidate in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
But Robert, yes, what you said is correct, plus what Eli just said, yes.
Okay. There's one other, before we get, I want to get back to contemporary politics, but one thing you note in the book is that the mode of, why don't we pause and say, what do you mean by the Israel lobby? Everybody thinks of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. When they think of lobby, that's an actual kind of formal lobby that sees its mission, frankly, as advancing the support for the policies of the Israeli government. That's what they say they do. It's what they do. Walton Mearsheimer emphasized that they were talking about a larger and loosely connected network, not some kind of centralized, conspiracy, not like some kind of octopus metaphor where there's all these tentacles and then there's the head. But a number of different kinds of institutions and groups that were largely on the same page and collectively exerted influence, but not always in coordination and so on. So how do you guys define the lobby?
Well, we talk about, as John and Steve did, a panoply of organizations, hundreds of them. If you count 160 organizations that someone said have now been organized recently to fight anti-Semitism, and you add those to organizations that used to have a kind of particular function in the Jewish community or between Jews and Christians, and now have kind of gravitated towards simply fighting to promote or defend Israel, or essentially not to defend Israel, but to prevent it from being attacked. So you have the Zionist Organization of America, the Anti-Defamation League, which, for example, used to do all kinds of programming to fight racism in America. It's given up all of its anti-racism programming and focuses only on Israel-oriented anti-Semitism projects. Tikva, the Deborah Project, the Jewish National Front, Friends of the IDF, Beitar, the Maccabee Project, Hillel, the Conference of Presidents of Major American Organizations, Americans for a Safe Israel, Campus Coalition for Israel. You mean go on and on and on. And there are many interlocking directorates. There are interlocking directorates here. The funding kind of spreads through them all. But you're right, there's no one central. AIPAC is not in charge of all of these. It's the biggest, most important of the organizations. What's the guidance from Israel? We use the phrase Israel's lobby. And that guidance comes in different ways. Informally, it comes through a natural convergence of an increasingly right-wing leadership among the best funded organizations, including AIPAC, sympathetic with the current government in Israel and the governments that have been in power. And we show in the book how Ron Dermer, who used to be ambassador to the United States, often referred to as Netanyahu's mini-Bibi, he came to the United States to talk to American audiences about how they should deal with the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. And he told them, as we show in a meeting in Cleveland, I'm sure elsewhere, do not engage with the BDS. Do not argue with these people. We don't want any dialogue. We want you to dismiss them as anti-Semites. Only attack them as anti-Semites. This is part, of course, as I've said, as we've argued in the book, this is the overarching strategy of the lobby, is to suppress debate, not to engage in debate. But if you want to see how that kind of message comes out of Israel and spreads through the lobby, that's a great example. So what was the result was that in almost 40 states in the union, legislatures passed laws against having contracts with any company that boycotted Israel, all these counter BDS laws, which are infringing on American freedom of speech, as various courts have found, all almost identically written, because they are the result of the lobby's decision to fight BDS by trying to suppress it and suppress support for it, not argue the merits of the case.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. Those laws, I gather, have not been overturned in some sweeping Supreme Court decision or anything, even though I think they've been challenged in the courts. And I say I'm surprised because the court had earlier ruled that boycott is a form of speech, right? Is a form of protected speech. And so what is the status of that legally, do you know? Because for people who don't know, it means that, like, the famous case that was, I think, brought to court was in Texas. It was just an individual person who had been working for, I don't know, maybe the state university system as a teacher or something, and they wanted to keep doing it. But in order to keep doing it, under the law, they would have to sign something saying what? They would never espouse a boycott of Israel, or they would never something or other.
In Texas, there was a decision that went in favor, and I think maybe in Arkansas, in favor of plaintiffs who thought they were being discriminated against by these laws. When a small business can't get a contract because it doesn't sign a promise not to boycott Israel. But there hasn't been a general Supreme Court decision that has rendered all of these laws inoperable. They are still functioning, and they generally require lists of all companies that are authorized for contracts, meaning they've been investigated to see that they do not boycott Israel. There are a variety of other provisions in almost all of these laws. We discuss them at length in the book. But what I'm interested in pointing out and stressing is that this is part of a much larger strategy to infringe on American freedoms. The Walter Mearsheimer book is about the compromise of American interests abroad. And our book is about that, too. And the Iran war is a great example of how the lobby and has an influence which damages American national security and foreign policy by dragging us into a needless destructive war in Iran. But we are focused also on this anti-Semitism witch hunt, which is being used by the Trump administration for its own purposes, but being used by the lobby to accomplish what it's been trying to do since the late 90s, early aughts, which is to prevent Americans from hearing or talking about the policies that the Israeli government has been engaged in the West Bank, in Gaza, towards Palestinians, and towards the Middle East as a whole.
And I do think that some of this does go back to, you know, the title of the book, America in the Grip of a Foreign Power. Now, I would never want to defend infringing on people's civil liberties or especially restricting people's ability to speak freely and avail themselves of their First Amendment rights. But there is something even particularly egregious about the idea that you are infringing on those rights to counter criticism of a country 6,000 miles away. That should be particularly shocking because people have seen efforts, certainly in the United States in our history, which are quite ugly, of efforts to curtail political speech, curtail all sorts of speech in this country, to really go up against the margins on the First Amendment to shape what is legally protected speech. The idea that participants in a protest at Columbia or people who signed or wrote an op-ed or signed a petition who happen to be green card holders are being deported because of that action is pretty shocking because, you know, even if you want to try to make some sort of a national security argument or some sort of carve out that doesn't really exist with the First Amendment, it's very hard to make it in this context because you're simply saying we're targeting you because you said something bad about Israel's behavior in Gaza in those cases.
Let's look at college campuses. I think there's a very vivid example of the smothering effect the lobbyists had on American traditions of dissent, discussion, mobilization, freedom of assembly, and so on. We all know that in the months after October 8th, that is when Israel launched its attack on Palestinians in Gaza after October 7th, that there were massive demonstrations in hundreds of campuses, and there were encampments. Encampments of the sort, I went to them. They have, you know, teach-ins. They were very peaceful. They had many Jews there as well as Palestinians, at University of Pennsylvania and many other places. These are the kinds of things that students do. That's what, when I was a student, we did it during the Vietnam. And now if you go to take a tour of Columbia, they'll point out where these demonstrations and building takeovers in Columbia, they celebrate them as part of the legacy of freedom of speech. Legacy of struggle, of moral values. And now we see that what has happened in order to shut down these demonstrations or even just any meetings having to do with the Middle East, universities across the country, including at the University of Pennsylvania, have developed speech codes and codes and rules for having assemblies or having events on campus that are so complicated that even I have never succeeded in reading them all the way through. No students or faculty understand what costs, what financial costs they might be entertaining if they organize an event because they could be charged for virtually unlimited security, the cost of security. This kind of thing has eliminated not only encampments, but across the country, severely restricted any student organization, any student or faculty mobilization. That is a great example. If you look at the winter and spring of 2024, compare it to the winter, spring of 2025 and 26 on college campuses, the situation in Gaza didn't change, but the lobby was successful with the help of the Trump administration to completely end manifestations of freedom of assembly and freedom of speech on this issue in American college campuses.
And Ian, is your sense that faculty members feel the chill? In other words, people who would have said things, written things without fear 2, 3, 4 years ago are just saying silent? And are some of them saying that to you?
Oh, right? Absolutely. And that's very, you know, most of the conversations where people will tell you that are, you know, don't say this to anybody, but this is the situation. And the situation is that that institutions and centers don't want to organize events because they will be some from outside the campus. Thousands of emails will arrive in the president's desk accusing them of anti-Semitism, and they just don't want that kind of pressure. And of course, the junior faculty and others, graduate students, are very exposed to investigations that threaten their funding because some student can anonymously say, on behalf, recruited by the lobby, anonymously say that this person made me uncomfortable. It's like all of a sudden the lobby has created all of these snowflakes in a college campuses that need to be protected, and the state is moving in. And we explain how Title VI has been used by the administration, by the Israel lobby, to deliver the kind of punishment. In fact, AAUP just published, the American Association for University Professors published a study about extortion. They use the word extortion is being used by the lobby and the government to shut down freedom of speech on college campuses and to punish those institutions that don't go along.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a segue to your argument about how some of the mechanisms of influence have changed, because my sense is that in terms of the pressure being applied to campuses, some of it is definitely the federal government, without a doubt. They have a lot of leverage. But there's also been, I mean, I just think of Bill Ackman, this billionaire who I think played a role in getting the president of Harvard fired. Of course, it helped that, she had, I guess there were plausible accusations of plagiarism. I didn't really look into it. And that was what finally made her vulnerable enough, I guess, for him to finish the job. But he is he's a big donor. And I gather that has had influence as well on colleges, the influence of donors, in addition to the federal government. Is that right? Because I know in a slightly different realm, in the realm of just politics, you emphasize in the book that I think the Citizens United ruling, maybe some other things, have elevated the role of just individual, like, yeah, billionaires in exerting influence generally. But is that also true in the specific context of universities?
Absolutely. I mean, at my university, University of Pennsylvania, Mark Rowan is the author, essentially, of what's called the Compact, which was a proposal that the Trump administration sent out to many elite universities saying, if you sign on to these provisions requiring them to do all kinds of things in line with Trump administration and lobby objectives about transgender, DEI, anti-Semitism, and so on, if you do that, we won't bother you. You will have your funding. You're welcome not to sign, you're not going to get your funding. To their credit, most universities who were approached, including Penn and MIT, refused to sign. But it was Mark Rowan who drafted that. And he at Penn was one of the moving forces in attacking President McGill, who was forced to resign later because in the aftermath of the inquisition that she faced in Congress from the Lee Stefanik Committee. So, yes, and I'm sure Eli can give us much more detail on different individuals, but we do in the book go into specific people who made specific threats, carried out specific withdrawals of funding because of the anti-Semitism.
The one that I always want to point to, which was happening in really it shows the linkage between the mega donors and the White House and policies that were being forced on American universities and on immigration policies, is the role that Mary Madeleine played through her Maccabee Task Force. Now, Maccabee Task Force is an organization that's sort of this pro-Israel organization, mostly, actually entirely focused on American university campuses. And it's headed by the former head of CUFI, Christians United for Israel. But they've concealed who the CEO and president is in their public-facing works. But in their IRS filings, it's shown that it's Mary Madeleine, the biggest donor to Donald Trump, the biggest donor in the Republican Party, and the biggest donor in our political system. And This organization was very active in advocating for deportation of green card holders, in threatening universities that if they, and advocating that the federal government should threaten universities if they did not crack down on protests on their campuses or allowing speech in various forms, be it in classrooms or in demonstrations or protests on the campuses that was critical of Israel, that the federal government should threaten to withhold federal funds and use essentially the levers of state power to coerce them to stifle this speech on their campuses. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. So again, whether or not it was McAfee Task Force, that effort that ultimately pushed it over the top for places like Columbia or at Penn or elsewhere, we can't really say. What we do know is that the person who had unique access to Donald Trump, and who Donald Trump has boasted about all the things he has done for her, was advocating for the exact policies that appeared to be enacted.
Now, so you're talking about Miriam Adelson, is that, okay, so, yeah, no, there, he did this funny thing where he was like, she comes into the Oval Office, and I say, Miriam, I moved the embassy for you, I did this for you, I did this for you, and she always wants more, and it's always for Israel. There's something kind of charming about his candor, but at the same time, you know, he's kind of giving away the game.
He is. I mean, it's something we certainly highlight in our book is that, you know, the Adelsons might be a little special in that regard and that they act with impunity. And they seem to nearly have pride in doing so. You know, we start our introduction is about, you know, Jonathan Pollard, the convicted Israeli spy, and his departure from the U.S. after much lobbying, the Trump administration lifts the parole restrictions on him. This was at the end of Trump's first term after the election. Lift the parole restrictions, Pollard wanted his passport back so he could emigrate to Israel. So many former and current members of the intelligence community, as well as members of Congress who had the security clearance to know what Pollard's actions had done to U.S. national security, had said for years, said over our dead bodies, should there be any form of clemency or anything done to reduce his sentence. But finally, again, his parole restrictions were lifted. His passport was given back to him. And you see him departing from Newark Liberty International Airport. There's photos taken. They weren't hiding how this was going down, of him getting onto a plane with the distinctive markings that are only on the planes owned by the Adelson family. They own a fleet of private jets. They provided a 737 for him that ferried him to Israel, where indeed he was greeted on the tarmac by Benjamin Netanyahu. So, I mean, that's the level of impunity that they operate at. And again, we as we get into Miriam Adelson, then immediately took to the pages of the Israeli newspaper tabloid that she owns, Israel Hayom, in which she said that Pollard should be welcomed back as a soldier who'd been abroad for many years. And she says, and this is sort of sinister, she says, to our American friends, this is an incident really best forgotten. But they don't care. That's the short answer.
That notion of best forgotten is, there's an amusing thing we pointed to in the book. One of the biggest, most important organizations on the scene now in the lobby is the Israeli American Council, which is an organization of Israeli Americans or Israelis living in the United States. And it's very aggressive when it comes to showing up and heckling and provoking pro-Palestinian or anti-Israel demonstrations on college campuses, among other things. Well, that organization is founded and funded by the Adelson Foundation. They just appointed the new executive director of it, who was formerly the director of the Adelson Foundation. When they had their large conference in Florida recently, Miriam Adelson and Chaim Saban were being interviewed in front of a mass of representatives in the conference hall. And the interviewer asked both of them, first Miriam Adelson, tell me, how do you have such extraordinary influence. How do you do that? Is it just the money? I mean, how do you do that? And so her answer was, I'm paraphrasing, you can get it exactly in the book. Her answer was, you know, I always like to tell the truth. So I beg you not to require me to answer that question.
That's, again, kind of endearing. So you mentioned Christian Zionists. I assume they also qualify as some of the groups, the lobby groups that are Christian, that are evangelical, qualify for membership in the lobby by your definition.
Yes.
And I guess the other thing, I forget how Walton Mearsheimer did the taxonomy exactly. I remember them arguing that some mainstream media had been influential in a kind of ultimately staunchly pro-Israel way. But I don't remember whether their definition of lobby included sympathetic members in the media. Do you guys talk much about the media?
I mean, we certainly get into it in terms of the consolidation of the media, particularly in recent years, CBS being a key example, but also the increasing focus on the social media companies, TikTok and X being certainly prominent examples.
Yeah.
But I think there's room for a lot more work on this. We talk about the way some of the most respected outlets in the United States, such as the New York Times, instructed their journalists not to use words like massacre or slaughter, which were commonly being used to talk about what happened to Israelis on October 7th, not to use those words when talking about what the deaths of Palestinians. There's a wonder. We talk about this, the way the media has been pressured to limit its attention to Palestine, to atrocities committed to Palestinians, how the agency behind those is almost never discussed. But I would plug another book by Adam Johnson called How to Sell a Genocide, which we refer to in our book, that is just an amazing analysis of the extent to which the media, even those that are attacked as anti-Semitic by the lobby for covering any kind of Israeli human rights violations, that those, Adam Johnson shows how distorted that coverage is compared to the way any deaths or casualties inflicted by Palestinians on Israel are covered.
Okay. So I want to talk more about this and the media, but both mainstream per se and, media that have recently come to be owned by, very adamantly pro-Israel billionaires. I'm thinking mainly of Larry Ellison and CBS and for that matter, TikTok. I mean, he's not the sole owner, but he's now in a position of influence. But first, I want to say, the structure of this podcast is most of it is a public conversation. And we generally go for 40, 45 minutes, which we've done. And then we move into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers in Non-Zero newsletter. We're about to move into overtime. But first, I wanted to give you each just a chance to do any summing up thing for the public audience, and any major thing we've missed that you want to say or whatever.
Well, I guess one element in the book that the audience should be aware of that's crucial is the change that's come over Israel. Israel was known and has been known in American culture as a kind of amazing place that was more or less like a blue state, progressive, social democratic, reasonable, wants peace with its neighbors, but beset by somewhat irrational and hyped up enemies. Now, there are some truth in that about Israel in the 50s and 60s, even though there were a lot of things about Israel at that time, including oppression of its Arab minority that people generally don't know about. But in many ways, you could say Israel was a kind of Rhode Island in the 50s and 60s, a blue state. In the 80s, once Likud won an election in 1977, the right-wing party, and then things went back and forth between a labor party that wanted some kind of compromise with the Arabs and the Likud that wanted all the territories under his permanent Israeli control, you've had a kind of purple state. It's been kind of Pennsylvania, Michigan, maybe. But Israel became Oklahoma. It is Idaho. It is not a country where you're going to get the kinds of outcomes that you would have expected in the past. And the cost of America having to have no daylight between Washington policies And a country that's gone rogue is much higher than the cost used to be. And the price that the lobby is exacting from America for that, in terms of the restrictions on our freedom, is much, much higher because of how extreme Israel's policies have become.
Okay, Eli, anything you want to say?
I would just add that, I mean, I think that that's all the important context that we are bringing. And I think it that this leads, does lead us into the, you know, the present day and the news cycle we're facing right now, where this has become one of the most contentious issues in this mm-hmm. campaign cycle. It certainly was a contentious issue in the past presidential election. It, you know, Israel and the Biden administration's policies toward Israel were the number one reason that voters who had voted for Biden in 2020 and who did not vote for Kamala Harris in 2024 gave for their decision to withhold their vote. So this is an important issue now, I think, foreign policy in the sense of certainly U.S. policy in the Middle East is a more top of mind issue for voters. And again, in our news cycle than it has been before. And I hope that our book can serve as an explainer for people who want to get a better understanding for how we wound up in this situation where now AIPAC is considered a toxic term for being thrown around by political candidates and where you regularly see conflation being thrown around about the pro-Israel lobby and Jewish Americans, something that we try to create a clear distinction between, even while the lobby works as hard as they can to try to make that conflation an accepted part of our political discourse. So if you're somebody who listens to podcasts, check out the audiobook because it's pretty good. And you might be somebody who listens to podcasts if you're listening to us right now.
You might be. It could happen.
Some people say.
Some people are saying, I think, is the exact quote. So thanks everybody who's followed us this far. I hope you'll follow us into overtime. If you're not already a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, easy to become one, link in the show notes and so on. And we will very much appreciate your support because it's what keeps us going. And now we are headed into overtime.